Jennifer Zamparelli on 2FM.
Fueled by Frank and Honest Gourmet Coffee. The perfect blend to kickstart your day. Barista quality coffee available at Centra and Supervalue.
It is sex therapy time.
Warning.
The following item is not recommended for little ears.
Because it's time for a dose of sex therapy with Rachel Cook.
As always, a little ears warning, especially with this one, and you can catch this chat on our podcast after the show. Today we're going to be talking about that episode in Bridgerton, which has caused, you know, quite a stir. The show's racy sex scenes have dominated talk on social media, to be honest with you, since its release on Netflix. But we're going to talk about episode 6. It's a bit of a spoiler here for people who haven't seen it yet. And joining me on the line is our resident sex and relationship therapist, Rachel Cook. Good morning.
Morning, Jen. How's it going?
Going good. Going good. So Bridgerton, I mean, it's hugely popular. It's one of those shows that we all kind of need in lockdown to get us through. But what actually happens in episode 6?
Yeah, so this part that really has kind of caused a storm. Basically, the character Daphne in episode 6 hatches a plan to be impregnated by her husband, Simon. Now, they got married under the condition that he could not have children, despite Daphne's desire to have a family, which she originally thought that the reason he couldn't have children was on the grounds of a medical condition. She didn't know anymore. But basically, she realizes during the course of the episode that the Duke likely can have children, but has been using the pull-out method during sex in order to avoid pregnancy. And so then what happens is she initiates sex with him, gets on top of him, and continues having sex with him when he tells her to wait twice and repeatedly says her name while looking panicked until he orgasms. So she stays having sex with him until he
finishes.
He ejaculates so that he doesn't have a choice. So that's what happens.
So what is the confusion about whether what happened is rape?
Well, this has sparked a huge amount of debate because I suppose, you know, on one hand, Simon was clearly a willing participant at first, up until the point where Daphne knowingly and somewhat forcibly takes control, you know, preventing him from doing the thing that she already knew he wanted to do, which was to withdraw before climaxing. Now, I've seen a lot of reasons given. There's been hundreds of articles written about this online and Twitter's gone wild about it. You know, but basically a lot of people giving reasons for why the scene isn't rape, such as saying that he consented to sex, so then he automatically consented to everything in it, saying that she was too small to have been able to force him. Some people have said that only forced penetration counts as rape. And other people have said that him saying wait wasn't really him saying stop or no, and that it was barely audible. And then others saying that she didn't really know what she was doing. And the thing about all of this is that holding a partner down to force sexual completion and conception while they object is rape. You know, this is rape, no matter what way you look at it. And I think this is an extremely important thing for us to look at. The withdrawal of consent at any time during sex is the withdrawal of consent. Consent can be revoked at any time. And so, you know, this is what happened here. Simon did clearly say, wait, wait. You can see he has a panicked look on his face. And she continued. Now, I suppose what's also interesting about this is the book came out 20 years ago. And obviously it's set in the, you know, 1800s. So obviously society's understanding of consent has changed since then. But that this is, you know, these are modern creators and directors of this show. And so what's interesting is the handling of it. You know, for me, I don't think they should have taken out the scene. But what's problematic is that it's not, there's no mention of this. It's actually framed as Simon having been deceptive towards Daphne. And actually, that's another interesting part of this is that some feel that Simon raped Daphne because she was not able to have informed consent because she was not fully informed about the situation and why he didn't want children or couldn't have children. So that's a lot of what's going on here.
A lot going on there. What should the show and the producers, what should have they done differently, in the episode?
I think, well, first of all, there definitely should have been a trigger warning. A lot of people were highly triggered, you know, especially survivors of sexual abuse were very, very triggered by this. So it should have been given a trigger warning beforehand. And then, you know, there's just a lot of issues around how it was dealt with afterwards. You know, like, it just wasn't discussed. It was actually framed in the show as a violation of trust between two consenting adults, not as a violation of consent. There's no accountability on Daphne's part. She never truly learns, you know, the lesson of what she did. She sort of informs her husband afterwards that he's not his father after it comes out that he doesn't want to have children because of his abusive past in relation to his own father. So she says to him that he is not his own father, and then he forgives her. And then he immediately changes his mind about not wanting to have children and gets Daphne pregnant. So Daphne sort of gets all that she wants. You know, so Daphne's determination to have children here, despite Simon's wishes, is framed as a sympathetic, it's framed as sympathetic and even empowering, with no acknowledgement of how this is prioritizing Daphne over Simon, especially as he's a survivor of abuse as well. Then we also have the aspect of race. You know, I think Bridgerton was very modern and ambitious in wanting to be sort of colorblind. And I think it's brilliant that the cast, that there's, you know, people of very different colors in the show. Mm. However, that was not really reflected well or handled well in certain ways, because, you know, it failed to acknowledge that Simon, who's a black man, was raped by a white woman here. And black men have been falsely and dangerously accused of rape for centuries, which further raises, you know, the status of sort of black male victims of sexual assault. So there's that could have been done very differently as well. So it was like, it was ambitious, but they didn't handle aspects of this very well. And so there's been a lot of outrage about
Absolutely, and rightly so. Can we talk about reproductive coercion for a second?
Yes, we can. So reproductive coercion, what is it? It's basically any behavior aimed at establishing and maintaining power and control by restricting someone's reproductive autonomy, denying them control over decisions related to their reproductive health, and limiting their access to reproductive health options. So, you know, this is largely gendered. This happens most in heterosexual relationships from the statistics that we have. Mm-hmm. And it is in heterosexual relationships, men controlling women, but it absolutely can be the other way around, and it can be any gender involved. But there's a few different aspects to it. So we have pregnancy pressure. So that's when someone pressures or coerces an individual into becoming pregnant against their will. It could be about refusing to negotiate condom use or refusing to use a condom at all. It could be the constant promotion of pregnancy, even though one partner has already decided that they don't want to conceive. It can be manipulation, emotional or verbal abuse, such as swearing and calling names to try and manipulate someone into having or not having a child. Another thing is forcing a partner to have multiple pregnancies and births within a short frame of time, which can make them very financially dependent and less able to leave. Then you have birth control sabotage. So that's when someone interferes with someone's use of contraception to cause them to become pregnant against their will. Stealthing, which, as we've talked about before, is removing condoms without the partner's knowledge.
Mid-action, yeah.
Yeah. Hiding or throwing away birth control pills, or removing someone's coil or something like that. Refusing to contribute financially to emergency contraception or abortion. And then we have controlling pregnancy outcomes. So threatening to leave a relationship or to cheat if someone does or doesn't have a child, using physical violence or threats or this sort of thing. So we're basically talking about, yeah, that could be emotional blackmail if someone doesn't comply with the preferred pregnancy outcome. So just to a reminder there, this can be people and couples of any gender, but it seems to mostly affect women at the hands of men in heterosexual relationships. So this is something that is, you know, actually happening in Bridgerton, which is also interesting that it has flipped the sort of standard in terms of gender on its head. But yes, I think it's a great conversation for us to be having, because yes, there's very different context in Bridgerton where, you know, women have very, very little control and autonomy. So it's a very different situation, but there's still reproductive coercion and there is still rape in it.
What percentage of men are raped? I mean, is it rare?
It's actually not rare. It's not rare. You know, we have something called male rape erasure. And a lot of statistics will say that about one of every 10 rape survivors is male, which is huge. 10% of people who are raped in the world are male. Now, some people would say, well, that's tiny compared to, you know, everyone else and all of those women within the other 90%. But that, you know, so many people would be extremely surprised that it's even 1% of people. So it seems that something between 10 and 45% of male rapes are committed by women. So still the majority of male rapes are committed by men. Mm. But basically, male victims often contend with massive stereotypes about masculinity that make it more difficult for them to speak up about their sexual assault and get support. So we're looking at statistics around the world seem to be that roughly 1 in 5 women are raped, 1 in 70 men are raped, and the statistics for people outside of that gender binary are extremely high for trans and non-binary people as well.
Before I let you go, I need to ask you, just to clarify, what actually is informed consent? Can we just talk about that before you go?
Yes, we definitely can, because, you know, there's so many different models of consent out there, and it's really brilliant that we're talking about it so much more, and that, you know, it is seen now as like incredibly important. The younger the people that I work with, the more, you know, pleased and proud I am that so many discussions are happening about, around, and before sex, about what each person's ideas are for outcomes, desires, boundaries, and what would constitute non-consent. But specifically around informed consent, that's informing your partner beforehand about things that might be important for them to know about your situation, which could be something like your STI status, your relationship status. You know, it could even be something like whether, if you have a sense that that person is absolutely looking to get into a relationship with you, and you are really only looking for a one night stand, the idea that you are informing them of your desires beforehand. Now, it's very debated, because some people would say, well, you are not obliged to give people information about your life. But I think that, you know, a lot of damage and hurt can come from people both making assumptions and also ploughing ahead without real care for what the other person might want or need, or what their boundaries might be. So informed consent is about giving people relevant information, which to a degree is subjective, right? But we have, you know, there's one model of consent is called FRIES, as in, you know, chips, Mackie D chips. Mm-hmm. But the FRIES is for, so F is for freely given. So doing something sexual with someone is a decision that should be made without pressure, force, manipulation, or, you know, not while one or both of you is drunk or high, preferably, or definitely not when one person is. The R is for reversible, so that anyone can change their mind about what they want to do during sex at any time. Even if you've done it before or are in the middle of having sex, it is absolutely fine for that to be revoked. The I in FRIES is for informed, as we said. Be honest. For example, if someone says they'll use a condom and then they don't, or they take it off during sex, that's not consent. That's rape. Enthusiastic is the E. So that's if someone isn't excited, if they don't seem into it, that's a very important piece of information about consent. And then we have the S, which is specific. So saying yes to one thing, like going into the bedroom to, you know, to kiss and cuddle for a bit, doesn't mean that the person has said yes to everything else, such as oral sex or penetrative sex. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of debate around the idea that all consent has to be verbal, because I think it's a very good rule of thumb. But I think if you think, you know, there are also reasons why, especially with trauma survivors, some people freeze up during sex and it is not possible for them to verbally consent to everything. So in those sorts of cases, what needs to happen is conversations beforehand about, you know, body language that you can use, things to look out for, like if someone seems to be not responding, if they've gone very quiet, if they are seeming not very into it, or they seem kind of glazed over, that you absolutely pause and probably stop altogether. So these are lots of ideas around consent that I think we are understanding.
We're exploring. Better. And I think just going back to TV shows, I think this is one thing normal people did really well throughout the sex scenes. He was consistently asking her, is this okay? Are you okay with this? And there was verbal consent throughout the sex scenes. If you remember, we discussed that months ago when it first came out. It's a really interesting conversation and worth having. It's worth having, isn't it? Every so often, for people to hear and become more informed and know about boundaries and consent. It's a really important topic of conversation. Rachel Cook, thank you so much for coming on the show today. We'll chat to you next week, okay?
Thanks, Jen.
Thanks, love. Bye. There we go. That's Rachel Cook. She is a psychotherapist and mental health consultant. She is amazing. She is our resident sex therapist. She is here every single Wednesday after 11:15. You can actually follow Rachel on Instagram at Rachel Jane Cook with the knee on the end of it. And she'll be back next week. So if you have any questions or topics or worries or anything going on in your sex life or relationship and you need help, you can remain anonymous. You can get in touch with the show, jen@rte.ie, and we will put it to Rachel because she is just phenomenal. Ah, now.
Jennifer Zamparelli on 2FM.